your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon, everyone. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Dennis Rodkins in the studio writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. We'll talk to Ian Scher from CNET a little bit later. And Elise Glink stops by to talk about, you write real estate, Dennis. We're talking to Elise about some of the housing markets around the country that are approaching bubble status, maybe red hot, right?
Yeah.
Nashville,
yeah.
San Francisco. I was laughing
Chicago
earlier.
Chicago won't even enter that conversation.
All week long, I've been unable to remember the day of the week, and I almost forgot the day of the week today. Well, I love it when you're here because I feel like we can gossip about our neighbors, and it's okay. We get paid for it. So the city council voted yesterday on this ordinance that we've talked about before. There's a state law that says if you are in a condo association or if you own a condo, mm-hmm. that the other members of your association are entitled to your contact information, right? They know the address, but phone number, email, and things like that. And the city council is giving Chicago condos a pass on that?
A pass on that, yeah. So this only took effect January 1st. This was
the new law, new rule, yeah.
The rule requiring, and one of the reasons that came into being is that the condo law in Illinois gets revised almost every year, but this idea was, we're all working on getting our building sold to a rental developer, or we have a special assessment or whatever it is. I need to be able to get a hold of all of you in the condo association, and I can't find you. So it seemed to the writers of the new rule as like a very simple thing. The condo board should have everybody's email address and cell phone number.
I mean, they all are engaged together in a common commercial
common ownership
venture,
of a piece of property, right? But it took effect January 1st, and by January 17th, two aldermen, Hopkins and Riley, had introduced a resolution or an ordinance in Chicago City Council saying we need to give Chicago condo owners a chance to opt out, because they both told me they had gotten literally hundreds of phone calls from condo owners saying, I don't want everybody in my building I intentionally keep my cell phone number private. I intentionally don't give out my email address to my neighbors. So they wrote this ordinance, which passed yesterday, saying that Chicago condos essentially they have to opt in to the Illinois law. Chicago condos are exempt from this unless the board, the ownership votes to follow that rule.
I understand the aldermen if they're getting all these complaints, but it's disappointing to me. I think I should be, I've told you off the air, I'm in a weird condo situation.
Right?
We bought a condo for my mother-in-law in Buffalo Grove, and the guy who's running the association, is unreachable. He doesn't respond. He's, it's been terrible.
Right.
And we can't find the board. We finally had some success. I just wanted to find the president of my condo board. I couldn't get the information. And so this is a case where if this stuff was published, we could get a hold of it.
It really is a question of what you think is your privacy. Some condo owners were telling these aldermen, and condo management companies were telling both the aldermen and me, that people intentionally withhold their cell phone number, their email address, because they don't want to be involved in the politics or the transactions.
Well, they are.
Like,
you know what? Then they shouldn't have bought a condo, because when you buy a condo, you're engaged with other people in managing a piece of property. You just are.
I agree with you, but I also see. But
what's wrong with you, Dennis?
I'm a reporter. I toe the line. But
Brendan,
so what the alderman
Brendan
said
the
was,
phone, yeah.
What we have to do is the alderman who wrote this ordinance both said that essentially enough people are concerned that this is a privacy issue that we need to make it possible at least to have this patch.
Okay,
condo boards may decide that this particular building doesn't need it, but if most of our residents think we do, we do.
Let's stay in Brendan Riley's ward. I think, right, this story over on Lakeshore Drive.
Yeah,
another condo. This is another one. Look, we're looking inside the windows here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I do all week,
good
Steve.
For you.
In fact, this is a building on Lakeshore Drive. It's 540 Lakeshore Drive, and what's interesting about it is there are high-rises on three sides. The fourth side looks at the lake over Lakeshore Drive. It's a 19-teens, once-upon-a-time an office building, but it's been condos. And so there's a developer. I was working on a story about the developer buying up condos in the building. Developer has bought about 37 condos in this 150-unit building.
Because the developer wants the land?
Developer won't say whether to convert it to rent, convert what is already there to rentals, to build on top, or to tear it down and build new. I don't know. They don't want to say, but they were buying up. They bought 37 of 150 condos. So the condo board just last week voted itself the authority, essentially, to kick out anybody who has sold to the developer.
So part of the deal was the condo owners would sell to the developer, and part of the deal was the developer would then let them live there rent-free.
Right, which is typical. Well, the rent-free part isn't typical, but living there after you've sold your condo to a developer is pretty common. When River City is going rental, we've talked about that. Many of those people get a deal to rent for a while after they sell. That's sort of typical. But apparently this condo board in this building felt that this was not appropriate. And so what they are trying to do, they now say that if you're living there rent-free, if you're living there after selling your condo, you're a renter, according to the definition they established. And the condo board has the right to evict renters.
Well,
so essentially what they've done is given themselves the power to kick you out if you've sold your condo.
And so they want to discourage other people from selling their condos.
Yeah, which so the developer couldn't comment because there's a lawsuit. But an outside attorney who looked at it for me said, well, yeah, what this looks like is they are, in a sense, vindictively trying to punish people so that anybody else would say, well, I don't want to sell like that because I'd be gone in a second.
Yeah, I guess they are punishing the people who are living there under that agreement now.
Right, and scaring anybody who might make such an agreement.
Well, I love that stuff. I'm glad I don't live there, Dennis.
I know. I do, too. I only have to write about it.
All right, Dennis is going to tell us about Julius Peppers, not his football career, but his real estate career. That's not so good.
It's not so good, no.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It's 1222 here on 720 WGN. All right, I wake up in the morning. I check my Google map to see how long it's going to take to get to work. And then I go directly to chicagobusiness.com and to see what Dennis has written for the day. And when I read your story about this house in Highland Park that Julius Peppers sold for $1 million, I thought Julius has a lot of money and he just wants this over.
And that's essentially what his real estate agent said. Not that he has a lot of money, but that he just wanted it over. It's a difficult house. I mean, I should say
Peppers is a former Chicago Bear, went to the Packers. I think he's with the Carolina Panthers now.
He was with the Panthers. So while at the Bears, he bought a house from B.J. Armstrong. B.J. Armstrong had taken a little while to sell it, not long. Julius Peppers only was here in town for a couple of years, and he's been trying to sell this house now for several years, and ended up selling it from, he bought it for 1.8, and he sold it for $1 million.
BJ built it, right?
He bought it from the builder.
Okay.
And I think probably...
I didn't mean he was out there building it.
No. Well, I mean, I don't think it was built specifically for him.
It was a spec, maybe, yeah. Okay.
And so Julius Peppers lost about almost half, lost 40%, $800,000 of what he had paid. And what's interesting to me is not only did he lose money, but he sold it for less than BJ Armstrong paid for it in 1994.
Wow.
He sold it this week for less than it went for 21 years
ago. Okay, so we talk about the North Shore real estate values, you know, and how they're struggling. Is this an example of that, or is this just one where he wanted...
I think this is both. The million-dollar market in Highland Park has been a little bit different because there is a very large oversupply of homes at that price. And this one also, I mean, this looks very 1990s. It's got these curved, the walls aren't curved, but sort of this, like where you would have crown molding at the top, that part of the wall sort of curves in and out. It's got like black granite and things that look very 1990s. So you're going to have to, and the exterior also looks like it's the material that people were familiar with in the 90s was Drive-It, which was sort of an artificial
stucco kind of thing. Yeah.
And so it is going to need some remodeling. I don't know that that's why it sold for as little as it did, but it did take a while. It's a great site. It's right by the beach where I swim. It's a beautiful wooded area.
I mean, I think the people who picked this up for $1 million
did a really good, yeah, they got a good right? deal. They got a house at a 1994 price or below. Although, as you and I have discussed, that's happening on the North Shore. This is one of the most stark I've seen, but we've talked about some, and I've written about more, where Lake Forest, Winnetka, Glencoe, Highland Park, people sell houses at prices below 2000 and in the 1990s range, right, which is startling.
Let's get out of there, come back down to River North. You write about an 1880s building that... Has it always been an office building, and now it's becoming a home?
It's been
an
office building for about a half a century. It was built as a house in 1883 for a milk merchant and his family. Yeah, one of the a prominent milk merchant who, if you track the company, it eventually becomes a part of Dean Foods.
Really? So, I love these stories.
Yeah, and Bowman Dairy, when you're coming down the metro, and you see that Bowman Dairy building that actually
familiar.
Says Oman, O-W-M-A-N, those are... latter-day versions of the original milk merchant's company. But they built it in 1883, and then it, you know, River North became an industrial area, not a residential neighborhood. And by the early 60s, it apparently was in really, really bad shape. This guy, Lee Flaherty, starts to rent it and eventually buys it in the early 60s. He had has a marketing communications company called Flair Communications. He also was one of the first sponsors of the Chicago Marathon. His offices were in that building for about 50 years, early 60s until 2015. And now it's going, the most recent buyer is putting it back to a single family
home. So what does that mean? They just are going to keep kind of the shell of the building and rehab the whole, I mean, if it was carved up for offices...
Well, you know, when you look at the pictures, it wasn't that carved up.
Okay.
I mean, they have said that they have to do a lot of rehab, partly because they're plumbing fixtures from the 1960s and that sort of thing. But it has been used. I mean, it's still laid out largely like a house or like two houses, because the back half is something that was built later after a fire. So when you look at it, you sort of see it almost looks as if there are two buildings, but it is one. And they wouldn't be specific about, because I can't find the name of the owner, they wouldn't be specific, but it'll be a 7,000 square foot house that dates to the 1880s.
I like that. I like, you know, those buildings you walk around all the time that they've been carved up into law offices or things like that.
Yeah, right.
All right, Dennis Rodman. Oh, let's do one more. So rent control.
Rodkin.
Dennis Rodkin. It's been a rough week. You know, it's B.J. Armstrong. That's what it is.
Yeah, we were talking about the polls.
There was an advisory referendum about rent control in several precincts in the election, and it all did really well, right? Does
that mean
anything?
Everywhere it was on the ballot. Well, it's really sort of a signal. There's legislation in Springfield about lifting the statewide ban on rent control, and that is a signal that where people are talking about it, they are highly in favor of it. But it was only on the ballot in 4% of the city. In those 4% of city precincts, it won by very large margins, but it's only advisory. So that legislation in Springfield sort of gets a little more wind under its wings.
All right, that's Dennis Rodman, writes about real estate. It's opening day. We could have gone Dennis Eckersley, you know, all kinds of possibilities. Dennis Rodkin, read his stories at chicagobusiness.com.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
Can you imagine that some markets now, the housing is so hot, Nashville's one of them, that they're worried about a housing boom. A housing boom. We're not suffering that here, as our prices were unveiled by Kay Schiller earlier this week. The Chicago market continues to lag way behind the rest of the country when it comes to the housing recovery. We'll talk about that later in the program with Elise Glink, but right now say hello to Ian Schur, a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how you doing? In San Francisco, by the way, plenty of housing problems.
You're about to pop,
We're in the totally different end.
Listen, I'm glad you can join us. We were going to bump you because Mark Zuckerberg wanted to come on. Mark's apparently willing to testify before anyone now, and I thought we were going to get him earlier.
Well, you know, I I'm sorry that Zuckerberg, you know, it didn't work out.
You're better. But I'm interested in, you know, and we've talked Facebook to death pretty much, but you guys have a story about how they were going to come out with a smart speaker. You know, we, WGN Newscast can be heard on the Echo, and Facebook was about to come out with their own, and they pushed it back because of all this controversy.
Yeah, so, you know, everyone wants to sell you a smart speaker these days, right? There's Amazon, Apple, Samsung, Microsoft. It's just endless. And so, yeah, apparently Facebook was also working on a smart speaker, according to some rumors out there. And Bloomberg reported a couple of days ago that the company has delayed it in the face of all of this privacy mess, which is probably the smartest thing they've done since it all started, because when you've got a speaker who's got a, you know, odds are a personal assistant in it, it's listening to you. When you're in the middle of a privacy scandal, the last thing you want to do right. is release a product like that.
So also I want to ask you another one of the stories that's kind of on the periphery is this lawsuit by some phone users, right? They're suing over Messenger because Facebook kept their records. Now, as I understand it, they kept the fact that they made a phone call or when they texted or to whom they texted, they kept that information, but not the actual texts, correct?
Right.
Okay.
So to be clear, you're correct. So to be clear, you know, this is all related to Android phones, right? Everything that's not an iPhone. And what happens is that Facebook wanted to become your messenger app, right? You would use it to text people. You would use it to call people. It would become the way you communicated with people. And so as part of that, it asked you when you set it up, and it did ask whether or not you were willing to share that information with the app. And so a lot of people did. They said, okay. A lot of people just mindlessly press okay all the time anyway. And then now we're finding out all that data was being sent to Facebook. It was part of your profile. And they had all of it. Now, not a surprise because, again, Facebook was honest about it in the first place.
Well, let me say this.
A lot of people were shocked that it happened.
You know, because I'm old, I was actually thinking of this week. Over Mother's Day, there used to be, we would do news stories where AT&T or whomever, back in the days when you'd call your mom on Sunday, they would talk about how many kids were calling their moms on Mother's Day. They had records of the phone calls. Now, I know they weren't probably checking actual phone numbers. My point is, this is the sort of information that the telephone companies always had on you, isn't it?
Yes, but this is part of the problem, is that the whole scandal we're dealing with here is Facebook being perceived as handling data improperly. And that is part of the problem, right? They lost control of some user data. Now people are like, well, what other data does Facebook have that's treating incorrectly? And this is another one of those flare-ups. In this case, again, Facebook was actually pretty honest about it versus, you know, what happened with Cambridge Analytica, where they didn't tell anyone about it for 3 years.
Right.
So it's an interesting kind of thing, but it's a good reminder. I use this as a good example to remind you that you have agreed to a lot of stuff, probably just passively pressing okay. Sometimes that's going to come back and bite you.
It just strikes me. I do think sometimes we become hypersensitive, and in the name of privacy, you know, our hair's on fire, and it's something that already other companies have done, and it wasn't an issue. I mean, it wasn't an issue that AT&T could send me my phone bill with all of my numbers, my phone calls listed. That's stuff I wanted them to have.
But that's something you would expect too, right? Is that, I mean, AT&T and Verizon, they should know what connections you're making over the phone. That's part of their business. Part of the problem with Facebook is that, again, even though they told you they were going to do this, a lot of people are like, well, what does Facebook need with all this information?
But it still is behaving. It still is behaving as a phone, right? As a quote unquote telephonic conversation.
I think a lot of people don't make that distinction. I think a lot of people look at it and they say, this is a social network. Get off my phone. That's what you're seeing.
You know, one of my favorite examples of this, Ian, is I used to love to go to the library, check out a book. Now, maybe I'm an offender here, but I would check out a book and, you know, you'd get the card catalog. You get the card in the sleeve on the book and
you could see
who else read the book. Kind of interesting. Yeah. Now, in the name of quote unquote privacy, they've gotten rid of that, which... it just seems silly to me. Okay, so let's move on from there. I want to talk, Apple was in Chicago. Tim Cook was here earlier this week talking about new education iPads and things like that. It's really all about them chasing Google Chromebooks in the schools, as I understand it. And now you guys have a piece as well about the Chromebooks and how people in the security industry love them too.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So, you know, one of the interesting things about these Chromebooks, they're not PCs, they're not Macs, they're like $100 to $150 computers that mostly are designed just to run the internet. And what happened was that when Google built them, you know, it was kind of a lark. And what's happened over the last few years is that, A, they become super popular because they're cheap, right? So, you know, a lot of people buy them there because they're cheap. A lot of schools buy them because they're cheap. But also, they are surprisingly secure. And so a lot of experts, the people whose job it is to make sure that networks aren't hacked and all of that stuff, they end up using them all the time wherever they go because they're just reliable, right? They're a lot harder to hack into. And it's a really fascinating kind of turn to see, you know, one of the answers out there is maybe if you're debating Mac or PC, maybe the answer is neither and you find something different.
Well,
and that's really fascinating.
So an iPad goes, even the cheaper one now is going to be in the threes, right? And Chromebook is 150 or something like that?
Yes. And the difference is important, right? The tablets out there and computers are able to run sophisticated applications, right? They're able to do all sorts of stuff. Chromebooks are really designed to do basic internet stuff, right? Create documents and Excel spreadsheets and print and read and all that, you know, stuff that most people can do in school. And that's enough for a lot of people. And that's why you see it kind of getting a lot of attention and doing well. Now, it's still, the Chromebook is not a huge part of the market. They represent a small percentage versus Mac and PC and iPads. But they're getting very popular with this group of people, the cybersecurity people, because it's secure, and with schools, because it's cheap and reliable. And that's really fascinating.
That's Ian Schur, a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, thanks for joining us today. I look forward to next week. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Take care.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. The Polsky Center is at it again, cranking out startups that are changing the way we all look at our day-to-day. One of the latest that has just secured $750,000 is Surratt Therapeutics. They're helping to combat migraines with a nasal spray. Believe it or not, their chief scientific officer said it's a very simple solution to a complex problem. I guess we can say that sometimes overthinking things can be the biggest hurdle to solving an issue. And apparently, the simple solution to update O'Hare is just to borrow $4 billion. Yes, billion with a B. The $8.5 billion plan to expand O'Hare Airport has been approved by the City Council, adding up to 35 more passenger terminals, making Chicago an even bigger aviation hub for the U.S. One of the downfalls is that the plan wouldn't be completed until 2026. Patience is key. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
All right, let's talk housing. On the phone line is Elise Glink. Of course, you know Elise. She is behind ThinkGlink.com and BestMoneyMoves.com as well, which is a tool for employers and employees to sort of measure their financial fears. I don't know, Elise, is that the best way to put that?
Financial stress, and then they dial it down. That's perfect.
Speaking of financial stress, so the Case-Shiller report, the housing report, came out this week. In Chicago houses, Chicago area homes up, I think, 2.4%. Nationwide, it's 6.2%. Chicago continues to lag.
It does. We've talked about this a number of times, and it's a little disturbing if you're a homeowner. We're seeing particularly pockets like on the North Shore where homes are selling for less than what they sold for in about 2006, 2007, which was kind of the height of the housing bubble, and we're still not back to where we were even then. So that's troubling for homeowners to have 10 or 12 years of nothing.
Right. And so nationally, home prices in January were 6.3% above the peak in 2006. In Chicago, they're still 17.8% below.
Yes.
So does that speak to the economic condition in the Chicago metro area? Or, I mean, because if supply is low, you'd think the prices would be going up.
Well, that's what's happening everywhere else. But what's happening here in Chicago has a lot to do with the state's economic policies and decisions. There, we get a lot of bad press nationwide for being in the hole financially. And having the, you know, the underfunded or not funded, depending on how you look at it, pension crisis in the state. And so the fact that we didn't have a budget for 2 or 3 years got a lot of bad play as well. And I think all of that, in addition, we have net outbound migration. So we have more people leaving, people who are wealthier. So there's a lot of reasons for that.
So your answer then implies that the housing market heats up, and I guess then as I say this out loud, it's obvious, but relies a lot on people coming into the market, not just sales of people who already are living in the market.
It's true. It relies on having people come in the housing market. It also relies on people having kids and wanting to be in good school districts. And so what you're seeing with the baby boomers are done, right? Gen X is done. Millennials are now coming in, and this is what I talked about in my book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. They are delaying marriage, home buying, and childbearing if they're even going to have kids. And if they're having kids, they're tending not to have as many children. And we're seeing that nationwide. But in Chicago, where the housing market is already a little bit not moving very much, having a whole cohort of millennials who are delaying home buying 7 years and delaying marriage and then saying, yeah, I'm just going to have one kid and I'm going to try and get them into school in Chicago, or I'm going to be in a more diverse part of the city because that's really what I want, or I want to live and walk to where I work. They're staying in the city, and they're not coming into places like the North Shore or Western Suburbs.
Okay, that's what's going on here, not so hot. But then I read that there are some markets that might even be on the verge or approaching a housing bubble because prices have been going up so fast.
Yeah, you are seeing that in different places, and prices are starting to come down a little bit. And places to look are in California, which, by the way, is always the harbinger of anything to do with real estate. It was going into the crash before everybody else. It came out of the crash. Now it's looking like a lot of people are also leaving California. They're just simply unable to afford to live there. There's just nowhere to live. And you see this at the very low end of the market. In San Francisco, particularly, the homeless population has just exploded. Mm. But I saw it when I was in L.A. a few weeks ago as well. There are just people who are living on the street because they can't afford to live anywhere else.
Nashville is a very hot city and has been for some time, and that's a spot where the housing prices are really taking off. And, I mean, are they taking off to the extent where it is trouble?
You know, it's interesting. I don't think that the Southeast at all is in trouble just yet. There are pockets in Atlanta that are a little bit overdone, but there's lots and lots of room to move around there, and there's lots of different places. The big constraint in the Southeast, and this is true for Nashville on a smaller scale, is going to be traffic and the ability to, you know, get through to places that you would want to be. None of these cities were actually designed or built to have multi-million populations. Even in Atlanta, where you have 8 lanes of traffic each way, it still gets really choked up, and traffic's a nightmare because they don't have the public transportation.
That's Elise Glink. Elise, thanks very much.
Hey, you're welcome.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.